Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight number 194, recording this on Friday, the 2nd of December, 2011. I'm Steve Litchfield for allaboutsymbian.com. Ewan's away at Eurovision. No, not that Eurovision. It's the other Eurovision, the junior one. But we do have Mr. David Gilson.
Hello, everyone. And if Ewan's not here, that means we don't have any geographically related quips, do we?
Hope not. Hope not. And also with us, we have Mr. Rafe Blanford.
Hello, everybody.
And let's get right into it. An FAQ, a frequently asked question. There's been a bit of hoo-ha around the mobile world recently, last week or so, Rafe, about a thing called Carrier IQ, which, as far as I can tell, is some kind of low-level network diagnostic software, loaded mainly into Android devices, but also into some iPhones. And it seems to be mainly American-based as well. But there are some worries that this low-level spyware might be in some of the Symbian handsets. Is that true or is that not true?
Well, the first thing I can say that it's definitely not in the Symbian handsets. Nokia's spokesman Mark Durant actually tweeted about this and said they'd ask Carrier IQ, and there are no Carrier IQ products for Nokia devices. So obviously that means that there's no possibility of having it in any Nokia device. I think actually the same probably applies to the Windows phone devices as well, although that wasn't specifically mentioned. There's been no evidence of that, as you say. It's just been Android for the most part. Apple have actually come out and said it was in earlier versions of iOS, but it's not in iOS 5. And in the case of Apple, actually, it appears that it wasn't sort of switched on all the time. It was only available in diagnostic mode. It is probably worth just explaining a little bit about what Carrier IQ is. The concern really came because it was a bit of software that was seen to be logging keystrokes, including stuff that was going over secure SSL connections, potentially passwords, tracking your location, and sending that back to a portal that was then accessible by a carrier and potentially others that had that data in an aggregated fashion. Part of the issue here is it's not entirely clear what was and wasn't available, because obviously when you're logging this kind of information on the phone, it's quite difficult to distinguish between something that's being logged and not sent and things that are being sent, although you might argue that things shouldn't be logged at all in some cases. And I would tend to agree with that position. And of course, the added difficulty is actually with contracts, carriers generally do have a right to collect aggregated anonymized data, and a lot of people aren't aware of that, and in theory you're meant to be able to opt out. So there's obviously been a lot of fuss about this, understandably, because it's a privacy issue.
Can I raise a point here, Rafe?
Of course,
this is a silly question perhaps, but surely your mobile carriers, whether Vodafone, Orange, O2, whoever, surely they already know every single byte of information you transmit over the network, because they are the network. They carry every single byte. They know every single thing, every website you go to, every bit of text that you send. Admittedly, there might be encryption on online banking, for example, but an awful lot of the stuff you do, including where you are every minute of every day, every bit of online information you access, it's all logged anyway. So isn't this a bit of a storm in a teacup?
It's fair to say that, I mean, you did note the exceptions with encryption, and I think there is a difference for things like location, which are being perhaps deliberately transmitted, and that might not necessarily be going over the network. There is a lot of data on a phone that never goes over the network. And I think more to the point is it's a deliberate collection of the data, whereas to collect it otherwise, you'd actually have to, look at the packets going past on the network, and on that kind of scale, it's not practical. So, yes, I mean, I'm reluctant to say it's a storm in a teacup, because I don't think it is. There are clearly some issues here, but it's perhaps not as serious as people might imagine. The problem, I think, has actually come because Carrier IQ, the carriers, and to a certain extent some manufacturers, have been very reluctant to disclose information about what's actually being collected and how it's being used. This kind of data collection isn't by any means unusual. I mean, there are various other packages that do similar things. I think probably the difference is here that people weren't aware of it. There wasn't any opt-in or opt-out. And that, to me, is the bigger problem, really. If you're collecting this kind of data, you need to make it abundantly clear to your users that you're doing so. And they can then choose whether to opt in or opt out of that system. So the fact that there, hasn't been disclosure about this, and then it's very unclear what exactly is happening, is the bigger part of the problem. I mean, the reason carriers collect this data in the first place is to maybe help if something goes wrong with your phone. They can monitor things like call quality, whether data connections are failing, and that kind of thing. And potentially if you ring up and ask for support on your phone, I mean, there was some software available for all smartphones, and it still is, that actually you install and acts a bit like a sort of a remote system so that carriers can sort of go in and fix things, you know, the equivalent, I guess, to the remote control on PCs. And that kind of software, in one sense, could be said to do a similar thing, but obviously that's very much opt-in. So I think it remains to be seen exactly what comes out of this, but people can sort of rest easy in the sense that it's not on any of the Symbian devices.
Absolutely. Okay. Moving on, Symbian Belle, we've been talking about updates coming for the existing Symbian 3 and Anna handsets. I'm seeing whispers around the net, Rafe, just from the firmware appearing on Naviform, for example, and other outlets, is that we think it's fairly imminent now. I would guess within a week or two, we start seeing Symbian Belle for things like the Nokia E6 and X7, followed by the N8 and E7 towards the end of this month.
Yes, I think that's a distinct possibility. I haven't heard anything official. The only timing we have is that Nokia said very early on it would be by the end of the year. And I have to say my guess of mid-December, which I've maintained pretty much from the beginning, is looking pretty good at the moment. And that will be the start of the rollout. I suspect the full rollout will easily go into 2012.
Oh, absolutely. I saw that today that on my news feed that the Nokia E7 on a particular Canadian carrier only just got Anna.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
it's just how long these things can take.
It takes time. We've said it before, but to be clear, the reason it takes time is quite often these updates have to be signed off specifically by a carrier because they do their own testing, which is why the SIM-free devices tend to get it first. That's not always true. And I don't think Nokia can always absolve themselves of responsibility for this altogether. I think sometimes they could push a little more. But just to note, it's not quite as simple as saying, right, let's update all the handsets because we feel like it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, SPV software, we've liked for quite a long time. They've done a range of really rather good Symbian applications, some quite low level, but all pretty good. And SPV have just been bought up by Yandex, which is, as I understand it, a Russian search firm, which is probably a bit of a shame because they're obviously intending to implement SPB's intellectual property and interfaces into some of the mobile related products they do. But you have to kind of feel sorry for the people who are heavily into SPB applications, that those applications may just wither a bit in the transition and may even wither altogether. However, it's worth noting that SPB TV is singled out. It's been hived off into by Mobi World Media, who are going to run it as their own separate product. I think the programmers concerned have been running it anyway. So if you're into SPB TV, as I am, a big fan of it, then relax, because that's going to remain a separate program, and you can just go to spbtv.com and you'll find the latest version there and the latest information. Also in from the SPB stable is SPB Shell 3D, which by complete coincidence, David happened to be reviewing this week in the middle of the buyout by Yandex. David, Shell 3D, I think it's fair to say, I would class it more as a demonstration of how clever an interface can be, how clever SPB's programmers are, rather than an absolute essential must download for a Symbian smartphone. Is that a fair summary?
I think, yes, it is. SPB Shell 3D is certainly usable as a home screen system. It really does show off what Symbian handsets can do. It's, for anyone who hasn't seen it, think of the Android home screen system, but on three-dimensional steroids. Yeah. You can have up to 16 home screens, and there is a preview mode where they all swirl around in a 3D carousel.
I'm hating it already, David.
Yeah, you can have as many or as few as you like, and it does have useful widgets. There's a full screen calendar widget. There's also like a small 4x1 calendar widget. There's a 3D swirling SMS preview. However, it is missing some very basic widgets that you have on the standard Symbian 3, Symbian Anna home screen, which are like email preview, music control, location check-in, social network widgets. So it doesn't do everything. So I think it couldn't be a full-time replacement for me. And it is I know this is kind of feeding into an editorial you did last week, but it is relatively expensive at around £10. So, I mean, you're going to have to really think it's worthwhile or have the money to spare to want to show off to people, perhaps.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about SPB here is, as you said, it's kind of a technical demo. But for a lot of people, they want to sort of have an extra bit of power on their home screen. And its origins, sort of before it was 3D, before the transitions came in, if you will, its origins were back when the Symbian home screen was significantly less powerful than it is now. And back then it was very much quite a boon for power users. I think perhaps with the latest advent in Anna, and in particular Bell with the variable size widgets, the need for it is maybe less apparent on Symbian. But for those that are maybe looking for something a bit different or a fresh interface, particularly on the sort of original Symbian devices, and you can't actually have the 3D version on anything apart from Symbian 3, but it is, I believe, available for a 65th edition in a sort of standard format. You know, it does offer an alternative upgrade. I think I'm probably a purist and don't like that kind of addition to the UI, and I would say the same on other platform. I tend to prefer the sort of pure implementations. I mean, Android had a lot of manufacturer specific UI customization and skins, some of which were very good. I think HTSynth's probably the pick of the bunch there, but some of them, maybe Moto Blur, was less beneficial. And we've seen the similar thing happen on Symbian. There are actually a couple of other products that have done similar things, both which are available now and going back into the past. But I will say, in terms of the implementation, very impressive indeed, and the programmers at SPB, the developers, really do know what they're doing, and they've created some first-class applications which are sort of almost unmatched anywhere else on the Symbian platform.
I will just say, on terms of integration, Shell 3D actually does quite well in that it doesn't seem to clash up against the basic Symbian home screen. You can tap on individual bits for settings and it will deep link into the right page in the settings application, for example. However, I do agree with you that, especially with what Bell is going to be bringing in the next few months, the case for spending £10 on this home screen replacement is really weakened. I mean, Shell 3D was released in August this year, so between then and now, there's a good case for doing it if that was your sort of thing. With Bell coming, Bell's very flat, two-dimensional, but I think there is a lot more functionality there. And also, there is a move in user interface philosophy that's coming, that you want something simpler that you don't have to spend hours and hours working on. And SPB Shell 3D suffers the same problem as Android does, and to a point Symbian, but not so much, in that you can spend hours tweaking it to exactly what you want, but if you have to reset your phone or buy a new phone, there's no way to restore that configuration. You have to start from scratch and start working on it again, which I think is why there's a kickback to maybe doing things, as I hate to mention it, but Windows Phone, where you just have the tiles and you just put them where you want.
Nonetheless, we should probably say that the reason Yandex have bought SPB, I would suspect, is around this capability for creating custom UI on smartphones, because it then has interesting possibilities how they could maybe integrate their services. And it, obviously, Yandex goes quite a bit beyond search. It's I think has about 60% share of search in Russia, and does various other sort of portal like things, much in the same way that Google or Bing do for their products. So SPB, I think, is a pretty smart move by Yandex to snap up this. You know, they've got a very competent mobile development team who have some expertise in sort of integrating services into their mobile applications. So it'll be interesting to see what direction that develops in the future.
Yeah, we wish all the programmers at SPB well. Obviously, it's been quite hard selling apps into the Symbian marketplace. I know the SPB apps tend to be priced quite highly, which is kind of a high-risk strategy. It's worked okay for Yanalisa with Gravity, but I think SPB are probably struggling, and they're desperately trying not to go down the race to the bottom price-wise, which is probably a race to not getting that much profit. So it's good for them. They've got some money, and they've got some investment, and let's just hope, wish them well for the future. One story I did want to just note is that NFC, which we've been monitoring very much with the Symbian Bell handsets all coming with an NFC built in, and also the C7, of course, and a few others. Some Taiwanese smartphone manufacturers, which sounds a bit vague, but it's reported by DigiTimes, a mainstream site, and it's just worth a bit of discussion here, Rafe. They're estimating 50% penetration of NFC into smartphones, that's across the whole price range, within 2 to 3 years. That sounds kind of unambitious. I would say, Rafe, if you just look at the sort of mid-tier to top-end smartphones, which tend to be the ones that our listeners and readers want to go for, we're probably looking at 80% NFC penetration by that within, say, 2014, 2015. Do you think my figure's about right?
Yes, I do. I mean, actually, this is one of the less optimistic figures I've seen for NFC implementation. And in one sense, I applaud it for that, because these things do tend to sometimes be over-exaggerated and people are very optimistic about it. I mean, we've seen predictions about NFC before now saying that they'll be in all Nokia smartphones in 2011, and we know that's not the case. And I think looking forward into 2012, that probably will start to be the case. Maybe we'll get a few non-NFC handsets from Nokia in its smartphone portfolio, but we know that Symbian sort of supports it, and Windows Phone will support it in sort of the next release. So we're expecting that to come in imminently too. Other manufacturers are also picking up on it. We've started to see them in more Samsung devices, and I'm sure others are going to pick up on this too. In terms of the cost of doing something like NFC, you know, the price is coming down all the time. It's sort of a matter of economies of scale, really. And so I would expect the sort of the component price of putting NFC into the phone to drop significantly. I'm not sure what the exact figures are now, but I would like it'd be like Bluetooth and GPS. It will just be put in, and indeed there are actually solutions now that combine NFC, Bluetooth and GPS into kind of a single component or a single piece of chipset that goes on your baseboard. The complication is you have to do a bit more aerial engineering for all of those to get them all working properly and make sure they don't interfere. But yes, I think that's probably a very accurate assessment. I would sort of probably say the 70% mark, depending on whether we're talking end or beginning of 2014. But I do expect the uptake of NFC to be faster than something like Bluetooth. And that happened, you know, surprisingly quickly, really, in the mobile world. And we are talking about smartphones. So, you know, we are talking about things that generally have a cost of, you know, £100 or above. I mean, there are some cheaper than that. But this will be quite interesting, because you then get to the point where NFC will be at a level where it's not quite the tipping point for me, because it's not going to be on every phone, but in some markets we have smartphone penetration going well past 50%. So that means the chance of being able to, you know, swap contacts, swap pictures is going to be significantly higher, and that sort of thing will drive uptake and adoption. And I'm sure we'll see, if not mobile payment services coming, you know, information on posters, being able to check in, get more information in museums, that kind of thing. And as it's a technology, I think is really very easy to use. It's an experience that I think has a certain amount of delight to it, because it just is very organic and it feels natural. I think actually we'll see it coming pretty quickly.
Yeah, of course, Bluetooth these days is completely ubiquitous. I mean, and it has been for, what, 4 or 5 years now, every single phone at every price point has Bluetooth. I do remember, though, guys, when the Nokia 7650, the very first S60 smartphone appeared, it had Bluetooth. And I thought, what the heck use is this? Nothing I've got has Bluetooth. And you could, at the time, a Bluetooth adapter that you'd plug into a USB port on your PC was £80. I kid you not, £80 it cost me. And of course, that came down incredibly fast. Within 2 or 3 years, it was down at £15, £20. And these days, of course, certainly every Mac and probably most of the top MPCs, they all come with Bluetooth just baked to the motherboard. David?
Yes, in terms of thinking what the heck are we going to use NFC for, I mean, but there will be things that we just haven't imagined over. I'm pretty much hoping that it's going to be used to replace QR codes, because QR codes are a great idea for having like a non-contact, quick scannable way of getting information, whether it be links or text or whatever. But QR codes are time consuming. You have to wait for the camera to focus, and you have to have a camera that's good enough. Whereas if you can just swipe the phone body over an embedded tag, say if there's a tag in like a shop shelf price tag or something in a tourist attraction, I think that would be much less inertia to use than QR codes.
Yeah, I think that will come in time, although it's probably worth pointing out QR codes are still going to be significantly cheaper to produce. NFC tags have probably come down to a price of around 20p when you're doing them sort of mass production. So I have seen a few magazines that have started to embed them into their covers, or we get them in, you know, adverts and things like that. But if you imagine that in a typical magazine, you might see an advert with, you know, 5 or 6 QR codes scattered throughout it. I think we're a while off it replacing them all together. But what I'm sure we'll see is sort of a combination of QR code, NFC tag, and sort of text on a single poster or something like that, so people can sort of take their choice. You know, obviously typing in the address being the worst option, then maybe the QR code and NFC being the easiest. I actually think the thing that I'm most looking forward to really is the easy pairing with headsets. So you get into a car and you tap to connect to your car, or you tap to connect to a loudspeaker for music or a headset. And that particular implementation, you know, feels very natural, and it's something that I think could be quite widespread. And I wonder if that couldn't perhaps be extended in the future, you know, the idea that maybe you could tap to transfer the contents of your screen to a bigger screen on a TV or something like that, once that kind of technology comes in for wireless. I mean, it already exists, sort of wireless HDMI, but when that's built into phones, that kind of natural tap interface or way of doing things does feel like NFC has the potential to be the leader there, even if it's just as it is for the Bluetooth headsets, used as kind of a setup mechanism or protocol.
Yeah, but I think NFC will be, like Bluetooth, as you say, utterly ubiquitous in a few years' time, and we just won't think about it. We'll tap anything we need to connect to, we'll tap anything we need more information from, and the tags will be there, the links will be there, the software will be there, the payments will be there, everything will just work. But as you say, yes, I think it's good to see estimates in this case that are not overly optimistic and that aren't exaggerated. So yes, I think we're 2 or 3 years off from seeing 50% penetration. But let's move on. I did do a piece on the site, Matching Devices Today to Technology from the Last Classic S60 Smartphone. Basically, I just wanted to highlight some of the hardware features, which kind of carries on nicely from our talk about NFC and Bluetooth, hardware features from the previous generation of Symbian smartphones that are kind of, some of which are carried on and some of which are kind of getting lost. And there was quite a bit of debate in the comments. I just want to go around the panel of David and Rafe. I'll just pick out a few of the items from my table here. Key lock toggle switches. I reckon they've kind of been forgotten. They had the most of the latter S60 third edition smartphones, and nearly all of the S60 fifth edition devices and the Symbian 3 ones all have this wonderful key lock. One-handed, you just flick it with one hand and the screen is unlocked, or locked again if you want to lock it later on. It's just a one gesture. The modern touchscreen phones, which are coming in from the other platforms, Android and iOS and Windows Phone, guys, they've got a button you press. You have to press that button and then do a swipe motion on the screen, and it takes much longer, it's much less convenient. Am I totally off base here? David, what do you think?
I agree and disagree. Because that swipe screen, I agree, it is more actions to do. And I think the best of both worlds would be to have both, because that swipe screen is a good opportunity to impart information to you about notifications, time, your agenda, without you actually having to go into the phone. So it is worth having it there. But
But
for example, on the N8, you can just tap the home screen and it will bring up a clock screen. So Symbian is already doing this. So, yeah, I want the slider on everything.
The best of both. Yeah, Rafe?
I sort of tend to agree with David. I actually like the combination of having both a physical home key button of some sort plus the slider lock that you're describing, because then when you've got the physical home key button, you can press that and that will often light up the screen. So think of things like the C7 and the N8 here, and you can see that kind of notifications that David's talking about. And I think more could be made of that idle screen. You know, there's a couple of companies over the years that have actually sort of taken advantage of that idle screen and done interesting things with it. I'm just trying to remember the name of one of them, but it slipped my mind. But, you know, sleeping screen or Nokia bubbles are examples where that kind of thing has been done. But there is a lot to be said for just the single unlock action. You know, it's very easy to use. It's very obvious. And there's actually less chance of it happening accidentally when you're sort of gripping the phone on the side. That said, if the slider unlock is implemented properly, it can become a fairly fluid motion. I mean, if you hold one of those phones in your hand and you can get at the lock switch with a forefinger, you press it and then slide up the screen all in one motion. So it does become almost instantaneous, but that's almost training yourself to use it to get around the limitations, if you like. So yes, I'm with you. I would rather see a slider lock key. And I think that probably reflects my Nokia device ownership history as much as anything.
Staying with physical keys is another one from my table that may be controversial. Separate multimedia controls. We had these on the N95, first of all, with a little dual slide system, which is always a tiny bit inconvenient because you couldn't actually control the media while you had the keypad slid out to enter text. But we'll leave that on side for now. But the idea of having separate multimedia controls that whichever application you're in, whether you've got music or a podcast in the background, you can just tap a physical button And it doesn't interfere with whatever the application you're in whatsoever. It lets you completely control your media. It's just so convenient. And they say some of the BlackBerrys have media control on their top end. Some other devices from some other platforms do have some kind of hardware media controls. I just think it's a must. David?
Yeah, I would love to have, I mean, even just a pause control of a... I'm looking at all the phones scattered across my desk, and I'm trying to think, okay, well, where is this going to go? And I can't help but thinking the designs are just going to be a bit too busy with all these buttons, say, down the side, so having skip back and forth and play pause. Yeah. In a way, I just can't quite see where they're going to fit, but I would love to have them. I think, again, having the multimedia controls on the lock screen is a very nice compromise.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'm going to disagree. I'm quite glad to see the back of the multimedia control keys. They were one more thing that could go wrong with the device. And I like the idea, and I admit, when I first saw them on the N95, I thought, oh, that's a really clever idea, that double slider. But in reality, I never used them that much. I will say that I think they were a good idea when we had the non-touchscreen devices. But now that we've got the bigger screen touchscreen devices, there's actually more room to fit the controls on screen. Now, that doesn't mean I think there isn't room to improve how they're implemented. And there are a number of devices. I believe there's some customizations on Android from some manufacturers, but also notably on Windows Phone, whereby that when you press the lock key, and we were talking about this in the previous item, you actually get the music or the multimedia playback controls appearing on the lock screen, and you control music playback that way. And so that to me kind of strikes as a good kind of compromise. Okay, you do have to press an extra button to get there, and then it is on screen, so they're not physical buttons. But ultimately for me, it was no point having such specific functionality as physical buttons on the phone. I do tend to think that sort of minimalist design, which removes buttons, is better than having the buttons for everything on the device. Because if you have that, well, should you have a button maybe for, I don't know, mute, which you do on some device, and actually I think that's probably more of a case of that, or accessing GPS or some other functionality, and you can kind of add these on. So I'm generally in favour of, given that there's such space constraints on mobile devices in cutting things away, and you have to really have a good justification for adding some physical element to a mobile phone. So I'd rather put up with a slight bit of inconvenience, as long as it's well implemented in the software, and not have them on the device.
At the risk of mentioning Windows Phone too much on the All About Symbian podcast, in addition to having the multimedia controls on the lock screen, as Rafe and I have said about, another really nice thing it does, you can actually get some on-screen multimedia controls anywhere by just tapping the volume keys, and it just drops them down from the top. The play, pause, and skip buttons drop down from the top, and you can just play and pause. Going back to Symbian devices, I know particularly on the E-Series device, for generations, we've had this voice control button mounted between the volume keys, and I always wish that had been reprogrammable, because that would have been a perfect play pause control.
Absolutely. Also worth noting, with these touchscreen controls, they don't work if you've got wet hands, you know, say you're doing the washing up and you want to change track or skip an advert. They don't work when you've got gloves on, etc., etc. So I'm sorry, I'm still a physical multimedia button person. I will disagree with Ray, but I'm sure the comments have been coming into the story. I'm sure there are plenty of other people to agree and disagree. Kickstand is another one that raised a few eyebrows. I'm a big fan of kickstands. I watch quite a bit of video, whether it's SPB TV or music videos or even feature films. I've downloaded off BBC iPlayer, that sort of thing. Yes, I know BBC iPlayer stopped working. BBC sorted out the stuff I've downloaded in the past. And I just prop the smartphone up on its kickstand, and it just sits there very happily. Every other modern device, they're so smooth and slippery, and you try and prop them up on a nearby packet of sugar, and then they fall over with a clatter, and then you worry about scratching and damaging the phone. They make a noise, and you have to prop them back up. It's all such a hassle. Why not simply have a little metal or plastic kickstand on the back that props it up at the right angle? David?
Yes, completely agree. I would love to have kickstands on devices. I mean, actually, funny enough, on devices like, say, the E7 or the HTC 7 Pro, that form factor of the screen tilting up, that is actually better as like a desktop stand thing than it is having the physical keyboard. I mean, obviously, not every design can take having a kickstand. So, I mean, as an alternative or a compromise, wouldn't it be nice if just in the box with the phone, but in as well as the mains adapter and USB cable, etc. There was just like a little plastic frame that would fold up, and but then you can open it out, it'll stand on a desk, and you could just mount your phone in it as well.
Yeah, I've got several keyring little utilities, the little plastic widgets that do that kind of job. Rafe, what's your view on kickstands?
No, get rid of them. Don't like them.
I'm determined to disagree with everything I say today.
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd make the podcast more interesting. Secretly, I actually quite like the idea of them because when it came out, I can remember writing nice things about the one. I think it was for the N86. And yes, it is a good idea if you watch a lot of video. But again, it comes back to, I'd rather have a device that had less that can go wrong with it. And these can be quite vulnerable to being broken off. And it comes back to the idea that you can actually buy a device, if this thing's really important to you, that has this kind of thing built in. And I am thinking of devices like the E7 and maybe the N97 mini form factor, where you can tilt it. And if you don't want one of those devices, there is the option of going the case route. And quite a lot of cases actually have the ability to act as desk stands in one sort or another. I mean, I think it was popularized by really the iPad and a couple of Apple's cases, but I remember these back a long time ago in the Symbian world. There were various case designs that were deliberately designed so you could sort of have them sat on the desk at a good viewing angle. And for me, that compromise is probably the right one, rather than having a sort of bit of plastic that flips out, that kind of spoils the nice lines of the device. And it can potentially be broken off. But this is probably, again, I mean, this is a very subjective thing, because I don't use it that much. I'm quite happy to prop it up on something. And I'm really, in terms of design language, I'm a fan of kind of the sleek designs. And inevitably, a desk stand will almost always, if it's robust, going to interfere with that kind of minimalist design ethos in some way.
I think another argument to make for kickstands is that rather than consuming video, which is like the iPad content consumption model, is that actually I don't have time to be sat watching videos all the time. But what I do like to do with my phones is to have them as a second screen on my desk, and they are, because smartphones are now our PDAs. So we can get email notifications, and we just keep an eye on our calendars and our text messages, which is one thing our computers can't do. So just having it on the side of a desk there, stood up with the screen facing us, and we can just glance across and tap it and just catch up on things on the phone. It is really useful. So yeah, if there are designs that can have kickstands, let's have them. And if not, please put a little plastic stand in the desk.
Yeah, talking of little plastic stands, I believe it was the Nokia 5800, the tube as it was known, actually had that in some of the early boxes, which was just kind of a fold-out stand that worked well enough. I mean, I do agree with what you're saying, David, about the idea of having it as a second screen. Although there, I would rather see better integration with a desktop, so you're alerted to maybe incoming text messages or calls on your desktop. And we have seen that in some versions of Nokia's PC suite. It's kind of gone away, but I think there's a potential for better interaction there. And actually, while I don't like the idea of kickstands, I can approve of the idea of a desk stand. And specifically, I think the Palm Pre with its touchstone charger with the inductive charging on the desktop was a really nice idea, and I'd be quite happy to see that sort of thing come in, because if the screen's on all the time when you've got it sitting on your desk, obviously there is a sort of power issue and the battery life issue. I mean, so some kind of combination of charging or connectivity plus secondary screen usage for a desktop stand is something that would definitely meet with my approval.
Yeah. Well, see the article if you want to see the other things, bones of contention that I raised, and all the comments on that. And thank you for all those as they come in. I have returned to the Nokia N8, as you probably guessed, after my dalliance with the N86 for this article. It's wonderful going back in time, guys, and playing with some of this older technology. I think, well, okay, we've lost a few things along the way, but we should also balance all of this by saying we've also gained an awful lot along the way as well. And maybe that's a good topic for another feature coming up on the site. We're also out of time in this podcast, so we're going to welcome back you, and hopefully next week. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from David.
Goodbye, everyone. Talk to you next week.
And a goodbye from Rafe.
Goodbye, everybody.
And you can catch us at AAS on Twitter, allaboutsymbian.com. Thanks for all your involvement in the site. We will see you next week on the All About Symbian Insight.